From Buck Studio at Wisconsin Public Radio, this is Zorba Pastor on Your Health. I'm Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor, here to talk with you about what's new in healthy living, share some down-to-earth advice, and some great lifestyle tips to help you get the most out of life. If you have a question for Zorba, you can call us now at 800-462-7413. And Zorba, what are our topics?
Yes, we're going to talk about the disparity in life expectancy between rich and poor and between rich and poor in one city versus another city. Some very interesting data. Interesting because I talked about it in my book, The Longevity Code, years ago, The Personal Prescription for a Longer, Sweeter
Life. Not that
life.
You're plugging your book.
Not at all, Tom. Not at all.
And?
Ultra-processed foods. A huge chunk of the American diet. What do they mean for us and what do they mean for our health?
And speaking of food, what's our recipe?
Pulled chicken sliders with apple, jicama, relish. If you like good, spicy, delicious stuff, this is for you. And I know, Tom, you are a spice man.
Absolutely right.
Not a spice girl, a spice man.
800-462-7413. Let's take our first call, Zorba. A listener with us in Spokane, Washington. Hi.
Hello. How are you?
Fine. How can we help?
Well, I have been recently reading some of the press about the connection between proton pump inhibitors and dementia, and since I have been using them for quite a long time and expect to be using them for the rest of my life, I find this concerning. So I'd like to get Dr. Zorba's read on this.
I think
first,
it's basically...
tell us what that is.
Well, proton pump inhibitors are Prilosec, omeprazole, which is over-the-counter without a prescription, Nexium, which is now over-the-counter without a prescription, the drugs in that class, widely used drugs. And the question has really been, there are a few questions, whether or not it may reduce magnesium, which maybe it does, maybe it doesn't. There's some interesting data about it, whether or not it's related to calcium intake and is whether or not either one of the causes of osteoporosis. Once again, the data is scant. The dementia data, I think, is completely scant. I don't think there really is any credible evidence that proton pump inhibitors cause dementia. And if there were credible evidence, I have a feeling that the FDA would put a black box warning on them, take them off the over-the-counter shelf, and say these are prescription drugs, and they would fall into disuse, and we'd go back to Zantac. So which is... Comment. Tell me what you take it for, how long you've taken it.
And... I have Barrett's esophagus, hiatal hernia, and now Barrett's esophagus. Mm-hmm. And so I have been on prescription things for, for acid reflux for years.
Okay,
years.
I want to stop for this one second. So to explain to people, Barrett's esophagus is a diagnosis that a gastroenterologist makes when they look down in the stomach. Okay. There is a theory that Barrett's esophagus is more likely to cause cancer over time. Sort of, it's not pre-cancer. It's a sort of like a polyp in the colon. In other words, it doesn't become cancerous. It's not even like that. It's sort of like it puts you more at risk, I guess, for esophageal cancer. And so gastroenterologists for years have been saying if you've got Barrett's, you should be on a proton pump inhibitor.
Right.
But the later data shows that although it's a risk, it may not be as much of a risk as earlier studies seem to show. So there's kind of a question about whether or not we should be treating that aggressively on a regular basis. I just want to pull that in because are you on it for symptoms or you want it because you had Barrett's?
Well, I do have a problem because of the hiatal hernia with the acid reflux.
Uh-huh.
And I had asked the gastroenterologist, I said, I went off of these drugs, because they all have side effects. And he didn't take me off. He doubled the prescription, which didn't work well for me. So I said, no, I can't do that. But at any rate...
why couldn't you do it?
Well, I started getting like sores in my mouth when I doubled the prescription. It was really weird. Mm-hmm. And as soon as I went off it, it stopped. But at any rate, I just didn't want to take these. And I said, can I take other things for it? And then when I had the endoscopy, it was like, no, you mm-hmm. can't go off of them. Do you want esophageal cancer? Uh-huh. And about that time, I'm reading these studies mm-hmm. that are showing it, you know, is related to dementia. And since I am pushing 70, uh-huh. a couple years out, well, I was like, I really don't need
like
that.
You sound like you're 30. You don't sound like you're 70. You sound you're 30.
Yeah, well, thank you. you're well-preserved 67-year-old.
Well-preserved. But 30-year-olds don't say we're well-preserved. They would never say that.
I know.
Although I have 30-year-olds that say, my goodness, I'm 30. I'm so old already. And I think, oh, no. You don't know what old is.
When you look at a 40-year-old and say, well, they're just a kid, you know that you've crossed that line.
Well, I remember saying never trust anyone over 30. Now I say never trust anyone under 30.
It's exactly. But, yeah, the other thing I was going to ask, too, because you read the boxes, and that was the other thing, was you should never read the inserts in your drugs.
Of course,
because
never,
you won't take anything.
They say
clearly that they're not intended for use more than 6 months, and I'm going, I've been on them for years.
Right, and that's because they were never tested in double-blind placebo-controlled trials such that the FDA approved them, because they didn't need them once they've been approved. It's off-label use, commonly used in medicine. I want to go back for a second. Zantac, which is ranitidine, over-the-counter generic without a prescription. Has that worked for you in the past?
It used to work years ago, but then it quit working. And so, you know, over the years, they've changed. You know, I've taken omeprazole. Uh-huh. I've never taken over-the-counter. It's always been prescription.
Well, you can, by the way, if you're still having symptoms. First of all, I would stay on the omeprazole. That's what I would do. That's what I would do for sure.
Taking pantoprazole now.
And pantoprazole. It's in the same uh-huh. class.
Okay. All right.
Same uh-huh. class. Is that working better for you?
It's working well. The best one that ever worked for me was Dexalant, to be honest.
Dexalant. Is that that's one of the prescription ones? I'm not familiar
with
this.
Yeah, and it's a mm-hmm. combination.
Combination of what?
Of proton pump inhibitor and...
Well, it could be...
Oh, what's the other one? Acid suppressor
well,
or whatever.
Well, you can make a combination yourself with Zantac. Zantac is the other one, an H2 blocker. That's what I was going to recommend. If you're still having symptoms, taking 150 to 300 milligrams of generic Zantac at bedtime, because that's uh-huh. that's what the combination was, basically can make a difference. And some people do well on the PPI and the H2 inhibitor, both together.
And that's what the Dexalant was, mm-hmm. too, yeah. But you know, I'm just concerned about the so rather than taking the prescription one, maybe just get some generic Zantac.
Well, it's the same thing. I mean, it'll be the same price. But 150, what I would do is take your proton pump inhibitor during the day. I would take Zantac often at bedtime. It works for people. Some people take it twice a day, 150 milligrams twice a day, or 150 at bedtime, or 300 at bedtime. I would try over-the-counter first, and if it works, call your doc and say, I want a prescription, if that is cheaper for you. Okay, mm-hmm. It's the same thing, inexpensive at big box stores like Costco. They're very, mm-hmm. It's inexpensive to get it. Sometimes less than your copay. And as far as the dementia is concerned, keep on learning, keep on working, keep on reading, and keep on listening to public radio, because that is the best cure for dementia known to man. We don't have to do crossword puzzles. We just have to listen to public radio 24/7. Everybody knows that.
I do all of the above, so which is great. Well, thank you so much for taking my call.
You are welcome.
And I love your show.
Oh, thank you.
Oh, nice.
Thank you so much.
Thanks a lot. 800-462-7413 is our number. 800-462-7413. And Zorba, before our next call, let's talk about New Yorkers and lifespan.
Right. Lifespan and New York is very, very interesting. You think of New York as kind of a place where the people aren't really very healthy. They're living in a big city. There are lots of problems. Well, you look at rich and poor, and you look at the data that has just come out, published in JAMA, which I think is very important data. And it's interesting. It's something that I talked about in the book that I wrote more than a decade ago called The Longevity Code, Your Personal Prescription for Longer, Sweeter Life. I'm not on a book tour, folks. I'm just mentioning the book. But I mention it because I talked about the importance of environment and the importance of money in health and wellness. And what we see in the new JAMA article that was published recently is, first of all, we see that rich people live longer than poor people. So access to medical care, which a lot of poor people have through Medicaid, Doesn't mean they're going to live longer, but what they are, and or they're going to have a healthy life. But we also see that geographical location makes a huge difference. So there are rich people and poor people in New York. We know that. The ultra-rich live in New York, the upper 1%. And there are very poor people who live in New York. And the longevity disparity in New York is minimal, is minimal. It's not just access to medical care. It's because in New York, years ago, they instituted no smoking in a lot of places. Get rid of trans fats in fast food. They, you know, when they tried to get rid of 32-inch sodas, then the nanny state started to rear its head. Yeah. That didn't work. Raised the price on a pack of cigarettes, so smoking rates went down significantly. Improved safety on the streets, decreased crime. All those things led to not only affect rich people's lives, but also poor people's lives. Now contrast that to, we'll say, the city of Birmingham, Alabama, where you can find that a rich person in Birmingham, Alabama, a rich middle-aged person who's then getting older, on the whole lives 2 to 10 years longer than somebody is poor. And that poor person has medical assistance. And it brings up that a lot of the health, longevity, and disparity has to do not just with access to medical care, but what's going on in the social situation of the city that you're living in.
That's really interesting. You know, most cities would not do what you just described as what New York City.
Oh, no, they wouldn't do that at all. And it's not just, it's not simply that. People in New York also walk more because driving a car in the New York is a pain in the you-know-what.
Yeah.
So they walk more, they move more, they're much more likely, they may be stressed more because it's New York City, but they're actually in a cleaner, better environment than they are in a lot of other cities. And it shows when we look at our healthcare dollars and how we spend our healthcare dollars, we don't think about these other environmental factors. There are a lot of other cities that are not just highly urban cities like New York, cities like Denver, where the feeling is of health and wellness, and we're going to try to be healthier. And it's not just people who are middle class and upper middle class, but that influences people who are in poverty, who also want to live longer and have a better life. And it just makes a difference. But it shows us how this social environment is so important for us.
Exactly. What was the name of that book again? 800-462.
Hey, I'm not on the book tour anymore.
800-462-7413 is our number. 800-462-7413. Now, Zorba, let's see if we can help a listener in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Hi.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Zorba. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. How can we help?
Well, about 5 years ago, when I was about 21 years old, I was a surrogate for my sister, who is unable to have children.
Oh, how wonderful was that?
Nice. Yeah.
How wonderful was that? That is so wonderful to be able to do that. How wonderful.
But since then, and after the birth, I've always been a pretty slender person, but I cannot seem to gain weight no matter what I do.
And you can't gain weight.
Right. And the only answer I ever get from people is, oh, that's so wonderful.
A few things. What have you tried to do to gain weight?
Well, mainly just changing my diet. I try to eat at least 5 meals a day and just take in as many healthy calories as I can. I really don't work out exercise very much. I walk constantly for my work, so I'm walking.
What do you do? What's your work?
I work for a medical supply company.
Okay, so you're going in and out of offices. Is that what you're doing, or just
right.
at one office? So you're doing a lot of walking throughout the day. Have you tried any high caloric foods? You know, things like ice cream or foods that are richer in fat.
Oh, yes. Yeah, I definitely try to eat my fair share of junk food and sweets.
As strange as it seems. Have you gone to something either like Ensure or Boost? Have you tried those?
I haven't tried Ensure. I have tried some of the other sort of protein shakes and meal replacers on the market, and I don't really use them as a meal replacer. I just sort of use it as a snack.
A couple things. First of all, when did you finish the pregnancy? When was that?
It's probably going on 5 years now.
Okay. So we're not in a postpartum issue where there might be postpartum depression or something else. If it's been 5 years, we're out of that window. A couple of thoughts. So first of all, I would recommend that you try a standardized protein shake, medical sort of protein shake like Boost or Ensure at bedtime before you go to sleep. Because we know that quite often people who eat at bedtime just seem – those calories seem to be different. They're not always the same. You're in your body. You're not moving. And there may be a difference in the way we absorb calories and extract them for our body when we go to sleep. So even though you're not hungry, you know, at bedtime, you may not be hungry. What I would do is I would try a protein shake at bedtime. And I would do whatever you're doing normally through the rest of the day. That's all I would do. And I would see if that made a difference. If okay. it seemed to, and I would give it some time. I'd give it a good 3 to 4 month trial. It's not going to happen right away. People who don't want to gain weight, if they took it, they'd get 2 pounds within a week. And my wife says she looks at food and it goes on her body. But you have a different metabolism. Protein shake at bedtime. See what that does. If that seems to be gaining weight, that may be all you need to do. If it isn't, I would then ice cream to it because ice cream is a high-fat item. And I would put it in a blender, once again, Ensure Boost because it's got protein. I'd add more fat calories and sugar calories with 1 scoop or 2 scoops of ice cream. And once again, I would take that at bedtime.
Okay.
And once you get to your other weight, you may then be able to reduce that. In other words, if that works for you, I would then try eating less of the protein shake over time. But mm-hmm. I would go off of it because you may then develop your old eating habits and walking habits. But clearly, you're just not eating as many calories as you used to for whatever reason. You know?
Right.
So
right.
That's what
well, that's another thing I've noticed is it's since the pregnancy, it's like. My brain doesn't receive the I'm hungry message.
Right, right, right. And that happens, by the way, with 5 to 10% of the population. And because everyone's so overweight, they think that you're better, that you're that you are happy. I want to phrase that differently. People who are overweight think that people who are thin cannot have a problem.
Right.
And that's
right.
wrong. And that's completely wrong. That's 100% wrong. So. Good.
Okay.
Try that and let us know what happens.
Okay, I will. Thank you so much. I very much appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Thanks. Appreciate the call at 800-462-7413. Now, Zorba, before we take a break, it's time for another edition of Disagreeing with the Doc.
Disagreeing with the Doc. Disagreeing with the Doc. Oh, oh, oh.
The following Facebook message came to us from a Wisconsin listener named Elaine. Dear Dr. Zorba, on a recent show, you mentioned using low-fat half-and-half instead of regular half-and-half. If you look at the labels, low-fat half-and-half has 10 calories per 2 tablespoons, and the first 3 ingredients are skim milk, corn syrup, then cream. Regular half-and-half has 20 calories per 2 tablespoons. If I did not have real half-and-half, I would just use milk and skip the corn syrup. I enjoy your program and always learn something from it. Thank you.
Well, I don't know if you know this, Tom, but I like coffee. I mean, I know it sort of
really?
Shocks you, but
you should mention that.
I like coffee, yeah. And I do not like black coffee.
No.
I like coffee with cream in it,
mm-hmm.
And I've discovered that, you know, it's interesting. I didn't read the label of low-fat half-and-half, so I had no idea it had corn syrup. But sometimes with people, we have it in the house who are trying to lose weight,
mm-hmm.
and so we'll have low-fat half-and-half in it. And I find, for me, it tastes pretty much the same way. So if that's where I'm getting my high fructose corn syrup, it's okay because I don't drink any soda at all. And it's not as if we have to rid our bodies of high fructose corn syrup. I mean, that's sort of the Spartan Puritan way of looking at it. We just have to reduce the amount of high fructose corn syrup out of our bloodstream as much as we can. So the answer is with half and half, you're getting more calories because there's more fat. And with the low fat half and half, you don't have as much fat in there because it's using a lower, you know, skim milk, as it says, mm-hmm. and you're getting a little bit of sugar. And you know what? Choose what you want to have in your coffee. It's only 1 ounce a day, and 1 ounce doesn't mean as much as a bottle.
Do you disagree with something Zorba said? please, you have to tell us. Just post on our Facebook page or send us an email at
Zorba@WPR.org or post it on Facebook.
Hang around. We have our recipe coming up, during which Zorba will tell us how to make apple jicama relish.
You did it.
Our number is 800-462-7413. More of your calls coming up after the recipe. We'll be quack, 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 quacking up with Dr. Zorba, too, right here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. More of your calls coming up, but before our next call, Zorba, pulled chicken sliders with apple jicama relish.
Yes, you know, you said that so well. You know, I mean, I am amazed at your diction. Every single time I'm on the show, I think about Tom, his diction is incredible. Did you take diction in high school?
Well, no, but let me do this again. Pulled chicken sliders with apple jicama relish.
Yeah, you know something. Once you give somebody the compliment, they begin to slide off the planet. That's it.
Okay, let's do it.
But if you like chicken, if you like the concept of sliders, and if you like apple and jicama relish, it's a good tasty relish.
This I never liked it. Sliders.
Yeah, yeah. You don't like the – well, don't you like sliders, White Castle sliders?
No.
But these are not – these are good sliders. Okay. These are not White Castle
okay.
sliders. Okay, start out with a chicken.
Chicken.
You're going to use half a lemon.
Half a lemon.
Two bay leaves. Some salt and pepper, of course.
Salt and pepper. Okay.
A cup of tomato puree. That's about a can. A can is going to be like a cup and a half.
Okay, cup of tomato puree.
A cup of Dijon mustard. A lot of Dijon mustard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a cup of Dijon mustard.
3/4 cup of apple cider vinegar.
Yeah, 3/4 cup apple cider vinegar.
I hope you're writing this down. I mean, you know, right? Are you? You're not writing this down. See a pen.
I don't have to. You're going to tell me where to get the recipe at the end.
True.
Okay.
3 tablespoons of firmly packed brown sugar.
3 firmly packed brown sugar.
A couple of cloves of garlic.
2 garlic cloves.
You're going to shake in some hot pepper sauce of choice, whatever you want to.
Some hot pepper sauce?
That's right. And then for the apple jicama relish, there are 2 parts to this recipe.
Wait a minute, jicama. What's jicama?
It's a Mexican vegetable. It's a yam it's sometimes called a Mexican yam. It's also called the Mexican turnip. It's sometimes called the Mexican bean. And basically, it is a rhizome, which means it's a root, and it has a particular taste to it. Jicama has a particular taste. Uh-huh. So it's sort of a taste somewhere between a turnip and a radish and a yam. Does that explain what it is?
If you'd like a copy of this.
All right. Start out with 1 Granny Smith apple. This is the apple jicama relish.
Okay. A Granny Smith apple.
3/4 cup of finely diced jicama.
3/4 cup of finely whatever that root thing is.
Diced jicama. And you can get that in your local Hispanic grocery store, Mexican grocery store.
Yeah,
in a good grocery store, or if you want to pay twice as much in Whole Foods, maybe 3 times as much.
Okay.
You can get it in Whole Foods, also known as Whole Paycheck. 1/4 cup of finely diced red onions.
1/4 cup finely diced red onions.
2 tablespoonfuls of cilantro, if you like cilantro. And if you don't like cilantro, use parsley.
2 big tea cilantro.
A teaspoonful of extra virgin olive oil.
Big tea, extra virgin olive
oil. Teaspoon of apple cider vinegar.
A little tea apple cider vinegar.
Of course, some salt and pepper.
S&P.
Okay, let's make the recipe.
Let's.
Place the chicken in a large saucepan with the lemon, the bay leaves, the teaspoon of salt, 1/2 teaspoon of pepper. Fill the saucepan with water. Cover the chicken. Bring to a boil over high heat. Reduce the heat to medium low and simmer for 1 hour.
Okay.
Simple. Even you could do that if you were motivated.
Yeah, I could
if you're
do
motivated.
That.
Motivation would be a different issue. Yeah. But if you're motivated. Okay, remove the chicken from the pan. It's going to be, you know, let the pan cool or take it out from the pan right away, as I will do, mm-hmm. with a big spoon. Remove it from the water. When it's cool enough to handle, remove the skin and then remove the meat. You know, you're discarding the skin. It's kind of a messy project, but now you'll have white meat and dark meat together, right. and it's right. been boiled. And it's really an excellent thing to do when you've got an extra chicken lying around in the freezer, as I do quite often.
Okay.
And then you've got a chicken that you're going to use. You're going to shred the meat into a large bowl. You've got white meat and dark meat mixed together, which is great. Then in a saucepan over high heat, combine the tomato puree, mustard, vinegar, brown sugar, garlic, hot pepper sauce, and a little bit of salt and pepper. Bring it to a boil. Reduce the heat to low and simmer until the flavors come together. Ooh, and the color deepens. It's going to take about a half an hour. Taste it. Season it with salt and pepper. Let it cool lightly, and then pour that over the shredded chicken. Okay, so the chicken is going to absorb those delicious flavors. Okay. Now, in a separate bowl, you're going to make the apple jicama relish. In a separate bowl, combine the apples, jicama, onion, cilantro or parsley, olive oil and vinegar, season it again with salt and pepper. Okay, so you've got two bowls. One is that chicken with the delicious flavors, mm-hmm. and the other is the apple jicama recipe. Now, spoon the chicken onto a nice bread roll of your choice. Mm-hmm. Maybe a Kaiser roll, maybe a Weck roll, which is what they use in Buffalo, maybe a sub roll, whatever you want to have. Stir in about a tablespoonful of the relish and put the chicken on, as much chicken as you want to have. And you've got this wonderful, delicious recipe that you can serve either at room temperature or cold.
I bet it tastes good.
It really is good. It really is good. And it seems like it's a lot of work, but it isn't. And I read a book called Rumen's Recipes, this wonderful, wonderful book, Rumen's 20 Rules. And the first rule in this particular cookbook, the first thing he recommended was think. That was chapter number one.
Okay.
And actually, he had a good idea. Think. So in other words, before you start something like this, think. Sit there for 1 minute and think about what you're doing. And his part of think was get everything together. Pull out all your spices together so they're all in front of you in an order. And then you know what? A recipe like this doesn't take that much work if you pull all the stuff together beforehand.
I think I'll go to the restaurant. Or how could I get this?
Or if you're thinking in a different way than Tom, you go to ZorbaPastor.org. This recipe, other wonderful recipes to ZorbaPastor.org. Go through Facebook, find us through Facebook, and please like us on Facebook, comment on Facebook, send us things on Facebook. We now get lots of hits on Facebook, especially whenever there's a picture of either Tom or I or a picture of Penny or I on Facebook. You know, the greatest number of hits that we've had on Facebook.
You and Penny.
Our Penny and I in Nova Scotia, Canada, 40 years after our anniversary, we're standing there. The way the picture is taken, I look like I'm 6'5", and she looks like she's a normal height.
That's true.
In a purple jacket. And we had more hits than we have ever had for anything else. Before that, it was Baby Bella, my granddaughter. Anyway, come to our Facebook page, folks. It's wonderful. And please comment. We love it.
800-462-7413 is our number. And back to the phones we go now, Zorba, with a listener in Antioch, Illinois. Hi.
Hi.
How can we help?
Well, a few weeks ago, we were talking about how can you tell whether you have real olive oil. And a simple test to tell if you have unadulterated olive oil is put it in the refrigerator.
Mm-hmm.
And at refrigerator temperatures, olive oil solidifies.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's adulterated, you'll have a solid olive oil at the bottom, and on the top will be a liquid, whatever oil they added to it.
Oh, does that hold? Is that what they do when they're looking for adulterated oils? I mean, it's a big issue.
We were talking not that long ago about phony oil.
Phony oil. Mafia producing phony oil because it's cheaper to put in with, like, canola oil. So, how have you checked that out? I mean, I haven't checked that out to see if, I mean, I haven't heard of it until now. It obviously has a different consistent, a different point of when it gets cool, when it solidifies. So other oil does not solidify like canola oil?
Right. They don't don't solidify at refrigerator temperature.
Really? So where'd you read this? How'd you figure this out?
Well, I work for the Food and Drug Administration for time, and that's one of the first things we put olive oil in the refrigerator.
Yeah, so you've got street cred. When you work work for the Food and Drug Administration, you definitely have street cred. So the first thing you do is put the olive oil in the refrigerator and see whether or not it solidifies. You know, you have just answered a question that I have never been able to figure out that has to do with how I make dressing at home. So I like making homemade salad dressing, which I always make with olive oil.
Yeah.
And when I take it out of the refrigerator, it is solidified. And I'm trying to figure out why the salad dressings that are commercial don't solidify, and my homemade dressing has solidified. And I've never figured it out. If we have, I have to leave it on the counter, or I nuke it in the microwave for 10 seconds. But that's because olive oil solidifies, huh?
Right.
Huh. Interesting. How long did you work for the FDA?
23 years.
23 years. So what did you do for the FDA? Were you in the food section of the FDA?
Well, I did several jobs. I was a chemist. I did forensic chemistry, drugs, and foods. And then I decided I'd like to meet more people, so I put in for a job as compliance officer.
Oh, very, very interesting, a compliance officer. So was that for drugs or food when you were a compliance officer?
It was for everything because they stuck me with imports, and with imports you have to know about all the stuff that comes in us to the Port of Chicago.
Oh, sure, sure. Very, very, very interesting work. It's quite interesting. We do, for many, many years, I did clinical research. I still do a little bit, but I did a lot. And I started my own IRB, Institutional Review Board. And this is many years ago, back in the late 70s, early 80s. Mm-hmm. And I'm still head of our IRB at our clinic. And when we had our first audit, because I started an IRB, and 6 months later, an FDA auditor showed up to audit the study that we were doing and the IRB. And I had everything all together, and I had read about the FDA and auditing the IRB. And when the auditor came in, I said, thank you very much for coming. He showed me his badge, and I showed him the stuff. And I said, from what I've read, you're here to help me. And he said, yes, we're here to help you comply with the regulations and the laws. And he said, thank you very much for welcoming me. Most people think I'm a snoop, but I'm not. I'm here to help you. And we got along splendidly, and he corrected some of the things we were doing that were wrong. And then he came back, I don't know, 6 months or a year later to see, and he made things better. I became a much better researcher because of the compliance, and we did a better job, I know, because of that. So I want to commend you on your job and your work. You guys at the FDA have done very, very important work keeping us safe in terms of drugs and food.
Thank you.
So, and thanks for that tip. That's an easy, easy tip to see when people are buying olive oil.
And we thank you so much for the call at 800-462-7413. Now, before the break, Zorba, let's take a couple salt-related questions that showed up on our Facebook page. The first one comes to us from a listener named Lisa. She writes, "Hi, Zorba. 2 years ago, I replaced my iodized salt with sea salt. About 6 months ago, I was diagnosed with subclinical hypothyroidism and put on medication. Is there a link here?"
Probably not, because we often in America, because we're often eating fish and fish products, it would depend on whether or not she's eating fish. The real issue with salt was goiter, not necessarily hypothyroidism, low thyroid. The issue was goiter, and goiter was related to a lack of iodine. And we just don't see goiter anymore because there's iodine in so many things, in so many foods and processed foods. So I doubt if that link was there.
Okay.
Yeah,
the next one comes to us from Diana in Richland Center, Wisconsin. She writes, "Is Celtic salt better for you than other salts?"
Celtic salt. So when you think of celts, C-E-L-T-S, what do you think of? Where are the celts? They're in the U.K., right?
Yeah. Yeah, okay.
So how do you picture a celt to look? When you picture the U.K. and Celtic salt, what's your image?
I don't have an image.
Oh, I immediately have an image.
But you're going to tell me your image.
I've got an image.
And insult a lot of people.
Yeah, and insult. salt a lot of people? Is that what you said?
Yes.
In salt or in salt?
I didn't mean the pun, but I'll take it.
No, I picture like it's on the sea and it's, you know, the waves are high and it's misty and it's cold and it's rainy and there people are pulling water in, and it's probably not like that at all. It's probably where they just take salt water and they figure out how to take it out. I don't think there's any difference. I think there's probably a difference in the trace minerals that are in it. And the biggest thing, if you were to analyze it, has to do with the packaging of the salt. And it'll say Celtic salt. So you feel like you're getting better salt because it's Celtic salt, and you're willing to pay extra money.
I was wrong. I thought you were going to insult.
I'm not insulting the Celts. I don't even know. I might know Celts, but I don't even know them. I don't even know what Celtic clothing would look like. Now, Scots I would know because they wear those funny kilts, but not the Celts. And the Irish you can tell from their brogue. But the Celts, I don't know.
Have a healthy living question for Zorba? Post it to our Facebook page or send it along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
We have some important research to talk about. That's coming up next. More of your questions, of course. Some quack, quack, quacking up with Dr. Zorba here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. 800-462-7413 if you have a question for Zorba. But Zorba, before our next call, we talk about ultra-processed foods.
Yes. Now, let's talk about what ultra-processed foods are, first of all. It's a very good phrase. I'd never thought about it, nor had I heard about it before. But they're manufactured ingredients that you would not be able to use from scratch. Mm. Artificial flavors, artificial colors, sweeteners, preservatives, additives. All the stuff in the label that you glance over at, like on a Twinkie, the perfect example of an artificial food, which has 42 or 45 ingredients, almost all of which are ultra-processed foods.
And now we Americans are eating more.
Well, according to this particular study, more than half the calories consumed in America seem to come from ultra-processed foods. So they're not things like salt and sugar and vegetable oil and butter and things like that. It's really these processed foods that are basically dishes and meals that are produced and snacks, and many of them are manufactured, and these are industrialized manufactured foods, to imitate taste so it tastes like regular food would taste, but they are ultra-processed, and they're fooling us.
What are we talking about here? What kind?
Well, we're talking about the fact that part of the obesity epidemic that occurs in our country may be from the fact that these ultra-processed foods are stimulating our taste buds to eventually eat more calories because we're not satisfied with them.
What I meant was, you mentioned Twinkies. What other kinds of stuff?
Oh, it's prepared stuff. You know, when you go to any particular store and you decide you're going to eat a prepared meal, when you go to to a fast food restaurant and you decide you're going to eat something there, let's say like a chicken dish, and the breading in it has ultra-processed breading. The chicken may be real, but the breading is not real. It's ultra-processed industrialized food. When you go, if you look at half the food that we eat in the country, it's either prepared for us at fast food restaurants or regular restaurants, or we buy pre-prepared food that we then, you know, heat up in the house or make from packages.
Yeah, and this is bad for us.
Well, the issue is, why do we have the obesity epidemic? That's kind of the issue. And this particular way of looking at it, if from an industrialized point of view, is very unique because it's not looking at how much fat we get, how much sugar we get, how much high fructose corn syrup, but how do we get in terms of additives and flavorings and texturizers, and are they really stimulating our taste buds and causing the obesity epidemic? That's kind of what they're looking at. So I think it's another way of thinking. So when you're buying food in the grocery store. Pay attention to Michael Pollan's concept. If it's got more than five ingredients, it's artificial. And if it's that artificial, it may not be good for you and put on weight.
800-462-7413. And back to the phones now, Zorba, with a listener in Wauwatosa, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hi, Dr. Zorba. Thank you. A few months ago, I purchased a sun lamp, which you recommended for people experiencing SAD, and I've been using it daily. But since I'm unable to tolerate the supplement, my question is, might this lamp have any vitamin D benefits? And also, is the ionizer part of this lamp safe to use?
First of all, the vitamin D answer, you do not get vitamin D from a sun lamp. It doesn't work, you know. So
no.
These lights do not do vitamin D. To go to that for a second, so you don't take a vitamin D supplement, you mean when you take a vitamin D, you get an upset stomach? Or
I have high allergies to almost all medication and supplements, and my vitamin D is only like 18%, so it's very, very low. I've tried three different supplements of vitamin D, and I always have a bad reaction. It isn't only stomach. It could be hives. It could be a lot of things going on.
Well, you just, you know, some people don't tolerate the supplements, and, you know, you want to try to get outside and get, I would say, from a vitamin D point of view, I wouldn't pay attention to the levels because a few minutes in the sun is not going to make a difference. But I would try to go out in the sun for 10 to 15 minutes every day, at minimum, you know, at least with your face in the sun, even in the middle of the winter, unless it's obviously a really cold day. Mm-hmm. Walk around, get some sunlight in the middle of the winter, and you will get some vitamin D, and that will be worthwhile. And then if you can tolerate, you know, milk that has vitamin D in it, which is a totally, it's not a supplement. They do something to the milk. I can't remember how they irradiate it, but they put vitamin D into the milk. If you can tolerate a glass of milk every day with some vitamin D, I would do that. So from a D point of view, and then it's not going to change the levels very much, but it was still going to make a difference in terms of that. So how do you like your SAD light?
I love it. It really, you know, and I'm not really depressed. It's mostly that I was thinking, well, I'll get some vitamin D from it. But then I thought, well, it really didn't seem to make any sense. The only way you get vitamin D is naturally or through the supplements. And, well, unfortunately, you know, it's been winter. So, and then it had that ionizer part of it that I heard, you know, some positives and negatives
about.
I don't think it does.
I don't think it does much for health. The ionizer does a lot for the dust in your house.
Oh.
If you have an ionizer, the dust, it charges the dust in the house, and it will often stick against the wall, though you may not notice it. So that's about what it does. And sometimes some of the ionizers will produce a little smell to it also. But keep the SAD light is great. It's a non-drug way to really improve mood for a lot of people. And for me, I use it especially in the early part of the winter when I'm most disturbed. November and December, I'm most disturbed. And after that, that doesn't bother me very much, especially after January 8th. For some reason, I don't use it as much, and I don't need as much. Keep it up. It's great stuff to use, and it's a non-drug way of helping things. So.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much.
Yes. Get thee some sun.
Yeah. We appreciate the call at 800-462-7413. And Zorba, before our next call, let's take another dive into the murky waters of medical quackery. It's time again for Quacking Up with Dr. Zorba.
Quack it up with Dr. Zorba.
Okay, Zorba, for today's Quacking Up segment.
I get more comments on that particular theme song and the Quacking Up than I get anything else. People stop me in the street and say, quack, quack.
We're going to tackle a question now from a listener named Samantha, who listens to our show on WESA in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. She sent us the following. Hi, guys. I read a recent online article about ASMR, which stands for Autonomous Sensory Meridian Response. It involves people being relaxed by whispering or crinkling paper. It also mentioned how people watch ASMR videos to help them with insomnia, anxiety, and depression. I did some browsing, and the most scientific resource I could find out about it was a website run by a doctor. But I still can't tell if this is quackery or not. Can you guys put on your quackery detective hats and look into this for me? Thanks.
Well, first of all, there's lots of quackery around. And part of the usual quackery is that it costs money.
Yeah.
In other words, most quackery is, give me money, I'll make you better. And it's interesting because there's no money involved here that you actually
look at.
Well,
yeah, you have to watch videos.
Yeah, but there's no money.
The videos pay money for videos.
No. They're... Tom, have you heard of the internet? You watch videos.
You watch videos.
You don't have to buy the video.
All right,
YouTube, and it doesn't cost you anything at all. I've gone to YouTube because I've sort of heard of this, ASMR. I didn't even know what it meant. Autonomous Sensory Meridian Response. It sounds like quackery. But when I looked at it, it looked to me more almost like meditation, almost like a mantra that is often used in Tibetan and Hindu meditations, where you're sitting there listening to somebody talking very, very softly or making sounds that are crinkling, and you're concentrating on that. And it's just like concentrating on a word or a sound that you're repeating or concentrating on your breathing. I have found that it actually calms the mind.
Just listening to you, I'm getting rid of depression and anxiety.
It's incredible.
Yeah.
And you know, Tom, if we talk like this in a very quiet way,
we'll put all our listeners to sleep.
And they'll be in a meditative response. And if they're in their car, they might actually crash, so we don't want them to actually
occur. Right.
But I do not think this is quackery. I think this is sort of a Western way of doing an Eastern meditative response. And it is useful.
That's really interesting. A non-quackery topic on
quacking up. That's right.
Do you have an example of medical quackery to contribute to this segment? Just send us an email at
Zorba@WPR.org or post it on Facebook.
800-462-7413. A Colgate, Oklahoma listener joins in now, Zorba. Hi.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Fine. How can we help?
Well, about a year ago, I started having bouts of gastric distress, like severe cramping and just abdominal pain, which at first I thought maybe it was something I ate. But then I noticed it was coupled with a sensation of vertigo or dizziness, which was relieved by flatulence and burping.
Mm-hmm.
And I have since cut out mostly gluten and high sodium content food from my diet, and it's mostly gone away.
Good.
But every now and again, it does come back. Mm-hmm. And I'm just wondering what that could possibly be.
Well, first of all, gluten, if you're gluten intolerant, and many people who cut gluten out of their diet aren't gluten intolerant by our medical definition of it. You know, when you actually do gluten intolerance type of tests that we do, blood tests and other things. But some people find that when they get rid of gluten in their diet, they feel better. I mean, so there's kind of what I would say is marginal gluten intolerance and maximal. And you may have noticed that difference in terms of what gluten does for you. Many people, if they're eating cruciferous vegetables such as broccoli and cauliflower, there's a whole list of cruciferous vegetables. If you just Google it, you'll see. That often causes a bloating and flatulence. Beans, because the way they're digested in the body, you know, can cause this too. Milk for some people can cause it. So what you want to do is you want to look in the diet, eliminate those things that do it, and just pay attention. And the reason is this has to do with the bacteria in our gut. You know, where we have bacteria in our gut that are symbiotic. They live there. They do a job for us. Some of them actually make vitamin K, but they also do other things for us. They help us digest foods. And then when some bacteria, you know, have overgrowth, they either make us bloat or they make us fart. And, you know, in our modern society, farting. We don't even like to say the word fart. Fart is, my mother would never say the
passing
word.
Gas.
We say pass gas. Or we say the word flatulence.
Yes.
But the reality is a fart by any other name is still a fart. And we don't even like to say it. because we're not supposed to do it. You know, whereas I'm sure 200 years ago in ancient, you know, in older societies, nobody really gave a rip of whether or not they farted. It became something when we moved indoors and had windows and could smell it. But anyway, getting back to the issue at hand.
Could you say the word again?
I've said it enough. Okay. I'll go back to passing gas,
okay.
I would never say the word fart in my office. I would say
gas.
Well, I'm doing it within quotes. I'm using the word in quotes.
Air quotes. So, can't be seen by our listeners.
So the reality is that's what it's your bacteria in your gut that are doing it. And you may discover that after you're sort of relatively gluten-free that you can tolerate some gluten in your diet. And a lot of people find that out, that they can do it. But, you know, change your diet and change your gut. That's basically what's happening. Beano, by the way, which is an enzyme taken in the gut, I've discovered a lot of people use it when they're gluten intolerant. And it also reduces the flatulence that they can have it. So, you know, they may want to go out to an Italian restaurant and they're concerned because they're going to bloat, which is uncomfortable, or they're going to pass gas, which is unseemly. And if they take some Beano before that, that can help them. So,
well, that definitely points me in the right direction then.
Yes. Well, thank you. Thanks for sharing that with us. I always appreciate those questions about gas. Gas is acceptable. It's an acceptable.
Yes. Well, you're very welcome, and thank you for the help.
Sure. Thank you so much for the call. Anyway, before we head out, Zorba, let's read a rather curious question that popped up on the ZPOYH Facebook page. A listener named Dan in Washburn, Wisconsin writes, "Hello, I was just looking on your website for the mighty mushroom chili recipe. It was my first time on your website, and oh my God, Dr. Zorba, that is a championship mustache. Do you have custom masks that would lend universal protection for it? I love it."
But of course.
I'm guessing not.
But of course.
Have a question for Zorba? Just post it to our Facebook page or send it along in an email.
Zorba@WPR.org.
See you next week, Zorba.
Stay well, Tom.
If you missed anything during the show or just want to download our show podcast, visit us on the web.
But of course, at ZorbaPastor.org or through Facebook.
And of course, you can call us anytime at 800-462-7413. Zorba Pastor on Your Health is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's not intended as a medical diagnosis, so please do check with your doc. Our executive producer is Carl Christensen, and our technical director is Brad Kohlberg. Our theme music is by Leo and Ben Sidran. For Zorba Pastor, I'm Tom Clark, hoping you'll join us for the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health.
Copies of today's show are available through the radio store at 800-747-7444. Ask for program number 0423Z. More information on Zorba, his clinic, and healthy living, including heart-healthy recipes, podcasts, and show archives, is available online at ZorbaPastor.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.